The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
The virus, which originated in Wuhan, has spread to every region of China. The infections have now utterly eclipsed the number of SARS cases during a year-long outbreak.
Russia is closing its 4,000-kilometer far eastern border with China to stop the spread of the coronavirus. Other countries have suspended flights to China, halted road traffic, and stopped Chinese citizens entering.
This does look like it could potentially be in that middle ground between something that's contagious enough to spread very efficiently, but still severe enough to cause a lot of harm.
So you don't think that we need to panic in the United States right now, but you do think that there will be pockets of fairly significant outbreaks?
I think that we can control an epidemic here in the U.S. if we take the right steps in terms of how we address the outbreaks that are inevitable. I think China
probably... Outbreaks are inevitable here.
I think we should be conditioning to expect some limited outbreaks. That doesn't mean they need to be large, but we're going to have some sustained spread in certain small pockets here.
Eunice, while, as you have outlined, so much of the economy remains shut down, the market is set to open on Monday. What are you hearing about how much selling people are bracing for?
Well, people are bracing for selling. There's a lot of concern about what's going to happen. They're very closely watching what happens in the U.S. markets just to get a sense as to how worried people are about the economy. But I think Monday is going to be a day to watch for traders.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Concerns over the coronavirus, Britain finally exits the EU, an impeachment trial likely to end this weekend. Hi everyone, I'm Jim Poplav, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me in the first hour will be Basil Chapman. He's looking at some key levels the market needs to hold. The good news is his weekly and monthly indicators still point to higher stock prices ahead. And then a special edition today as we take a look at those certainties of life, which are death and taxes. Joining me in the second hour will be author Dominic Frisby as we discuss his new book, Daylight Robbery, How Tax Shaped Our Past and Will Likely Change Our Future, as we take a look at some of the major events in history that have occurred have been driven by taxes. We'll talk about that in the second hour, and Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets.
This week for the market wrap, let's look at three key drivers moving the market. There can be no surprise again that the coronavirus is at the heart of economic concern, as its effects are spread through travel, tourism, and more, and recently hit an outbreak level that has exceeded the severe acute respiratory syndrome, SARS, back in 2003, which so far had a higher mortality rate of 9.6% versus 2.2% for the coronavirus, according to the World Health Organization. The economic effect could hit China's economy by $60 billion this quarter alone. And this comes at a time when China was already having difficulty expanding its manufacturing, with a purchasing manager's index reading of 50, which is break-even for January, with many believing the full effect of the virus hasn't been felt yet. While the Phase 1 trade deal was a step forward for the country, this feels like it's going to be maybe two steps back, at least short-term. The market rallied briefly Thursday on news from the World Health Organization, which recognized it as an international concern, but did not recommend restricting travel. However, Friday, American Airlines and Delta Airlines did just that, announcing they will suspend all U.S.-China flights, and several countries have made similar decisions. Now, the coronavirus spells tough times on one of the largest world economies, and that's why we're seeing the effect reverberate through global cyclical large-cap stocks and commodities like copper, down 12 days in a row, crude down 16 of the last 19 days so far in January, to the low of near 50 again. Gold is thriving in this environment, though, with easy money from central banks, political unrest, on top of the uncertainty surrounding the severity of the new coronavirus, and what those effects will be on the global economy, not just China. One final thing I'd like to say about the coronavirus topic, and that's the Chinese stock market has been closed since January 23rd. So we have no idea of the effect this is having on its financial markets with it being closed. And I think a lot of fear that their market will open up significantly down on Monday next week exacerbated the selling on Friday to close the week on the lows in anticipation of that. In addition, China banks are due to pay pay back 1 trillion won in short-term funds, so be sure to follow the currency too on Monday, not just the markets and stocks. One positive I've been reading is several biotech firms have been researching treatments and are at the experimental stage. Imagine what could happen if just one of those can work, what it might do to the financial markets and help encourage a rally. Moving on, let's talk about earnings, as it was the next driver I'd like to talk about this week. A long list of reports were released with winners and losers. Obviously, 45% of the companies in the S&P 500 have reported as of midday Friday when I went to work on this, and 69% of those reported and beat estimates. Due to many technology companies and consumer discretionary companies reporting this week, the anticipated decline in earnings for the S&P 500 has closed the gap by a lot. Down 1.8% as of last week, now only down 0.3% for the fourth quarter, and that's huge. The two sectors reporting the most disappointing results have been energy and utilities. Taking a look at some of the specific names this week, Amazon, on its results, hit a $1 trillion market cap. On a hugely positive response to one-day availability and shipping and an increase in Prime membership, Caterpillar, which is a decent barometer of global growth, beat earnings but guided lower on the quarter. Tesla was another big winner this week, which, looking at its results, with deliveries comfortably exceeding 500,000 going forward, with production of their SUV kicking off recently. Tesla is worth now more than Ford, General Motors, and Fiat Chrysler combined in their market caps. In other areas, AMD, chip company, and Xilinx issued disappointing revenue guidance, so we saw semiconductors not do so well this week, obviously on top of China and the coronavirus. The SMH ETF broke through its 50-day moving average. Now, the giant Apple reported this week surprising estimates on many angles. Quarterly revenues hit a new record, right around $91.8 billion, and net income of $22 billion. Earnings per share up 19%, all new records. So pretty amazing results ahead of a year. The company will likely see even more demand for its lower priced option of the iPhone set to release soon. And then they'll benefit greatly from the demand to convert all of its entire base to 5G. Finally, let's head on the final catalyst to kind of talk about this week. That was the Federal Reserve met and gave its decision to leave rates the same, and then decided to push out their repurchase options out to April from January. Now, Powell highlighted two things in the conference call, saying that the coronavirus, they are monitoring it, but that it's too early to ease if the market's looking for one. He said basically not yet. And regarding asset valuations, he said somewhat elevated, but not at extremes. With narrow risk spreads and high P.E. ratios, I think FactSet was talking about forward P.E. ratio of around 18.7 with, I think, $177 per share on the S&P 500 earnings, which is also projected at a record level. He said the premium you're getting paid to own equities rather than risk-free debt is fairly low. The next time they meet will be March 18th, and currently there's only a 31% probability. The last time I took a look at the federal fund futures on what that might be if we're going to get a rate cut, and obviously at 31%, that's really low. And that's it for the market report. The big worry next week is how China will open Monday and its effect on global financial markets. Looking at the Chinese Shanghai Composite, back in May 6th when they reopened trading after Trump and Xi parted ways from the trade table, the Shanghai fell 5.5% at the close. So basically, buckle up on Monday. And I think, like I said, a lot of what we saw on Friday was in anticipation of that. And that's it for this market report.
Why is this business cycle, the longest in recorded U.S. history, so different than the ones we've experienced in the past? And what are some of the various possible shocks that we could see to the economy or the financial system in 2020 and the years ahead? In today's FS Insider interview, we caught up with the well-known forecaster and strategist Gary Schilling to talk about his 2020 outlook, why this business cycle is so different, his thoughts on China, the U.S.-China trade war, and how he is currently positioned in the markets. Here's a clip of what Gary had to tell listeners in this week's FS Insider.
way back, they called the business cycles inventory cycles, and that's what they were when the Western economies were basically manufacturing-oriented. Well, now, of course, as economies grow, we spend proportionally less on goods and proportionally more on services. You can put only so many cars in your driveway, but you can spend infinite money on travel, recreation, healthcare, and so on. Services, by general, don't have inventories. They are consumed as produced. So you simply, the shift in the economy, you have less emphasis on inventory. So inventory cycles are still there, but they're not really that substantial. As you point out, there have been other measures, inventory control measures and so on, just-in-time delivery. That's no longer a big factor in the economy.
So if you'd like to hear this full interview with Gary Schilling, the renowned forecaster and investment strategist, all you have to do is go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
What's your retirement goal? When it comes to retirement, you've probably heard it's all about achieving your number. At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we believe retirement is all about you. You are not a number. You can achieve your retirement dreams and goals. Let us help you create a consistent source of income, make the best choices on Social Security and Medicare benefits, and build your legacy for the future. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939. Let's work together and make your dreams come true. Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
After a run-up over the last couple of weeks, the market is stumbling. All kinds of fears over the coronavirus. Could this put an end to global growth and trade? Let's find out. Joining us on the program is Basil Chapman. Basil, let's begin right from the top and take a look at where we are, beginning with the major indexes. Let's begin with the Dow, which seems to, recent piece, you've got some stocks in the Dow like Apple that are doing well, Microsoft, and you have others that are breaking down, which is still keeping the Dow somewhat elevated. So what's your take here?
Hi, Jim. So what I'm looking at here is, on the shorter term, the Dow is weak. The IWM is very weak. That's the Russell 2000. The New York Stock Exchange is also fairly weak, and that's the very broad index. And yet, the S&P is a little bit better than the Dow, and the Qs, the NDX 100, is still very good. So on the short term, I've got some sell signals. I had started on Monday, the 23rd. I got a sell signal on the Dow, and then it was followed with the S&P and then the Qs. But what's really interesting here is that my weekly charts are still technically very strong, and the monthly charts are even stronger. And I suspect that that's pointing to much higher prices in 2020. But at the same time, I think we're in a digestive phase, and that's reflective very much, as you were saying, in the Dow. You've got some stocks, for instance, 3M was down huge the other day with Boeing, and yet the market it managed to stabilize because Apple was so strong. And I contended, we spoke about this when we were talking back earlier in 2019. I said that the Dow isn't the Dow Industrials anymore. It's really the Dow 30. There are very few real industrials. They're Boeing, you can consider an industrial. But are we talking about, a Cisco, an industrial, a CVX? No. So I think what we're looking at here is the diversity within the Dow is seeing, in some ways, a rolling correction, so that some stocks are way off their highs. Some stocks that were doing really nicely, like UNH, United Health, taking quite a beating and then trying to come back. And at the same time, we're looking at stocks that have been winners all year, trying to hold on to those gains, and that's Microsoft and Amazon. So that's the fight we can see. Even today, we were down over 200 points, and now, as we're speaking, we're up 99. So that's reflected in the market. And within that, you can see over the various indices that the small caps have done very poorly in this particular environment.
You mentioned, like, within the Dow, you have stocks like Microsoft, Apple that are doing very well, blowout earnings for these companies. And then, you have technology, which has been a strong performer last year. Even when we were in the safety trade, you have some of that safety trade going on, but you still have technology. So it looks like, at least from the charts, that technology tends to be a strong leader and performer, regardless of what's going on with the rest of the market.
That leads me to the very next thing. The semiconductor index, the SMHs, which of course is a very big part of the whole tech sector, they were leading, and for years now, they've been leaders on the upside, leaders on the downside. And they gave sell signals. The SMH gave me a sell signal on the 24th at 150.74 was the high. Very next day, gap down. And now it's struggling. And I think that in some ways, you can consider this SMH as like the canary in the coal mine, the upside and the downside. So I'm watching this very closely because since I'm a technical analyst, I have to say that if there's a breakdown, and the SMHs, which are at 140 right now, 142 actually as we speak, if they start to take out the 138 support, 138, 137, that starts to impact the weekly chart, the 14-period moving average. And then I would say to you that we've got to watch that very closely because that would, I'm not sure what the percentage is, but I think that would impact the Qs, that's the index 100, but certainly the XLK and the XLK. At this particular time, that is the S&P Select Tech Spider Fund, is very close to all-time highs. It's trading at 97.95. And I would say that if at any point in the next 2-3 weeks, if we start to see it under 94, maybe closing a week on a weekly basis under 94, that's going to be in a digestive phase. But even then, my monthly chart is in leg C in the Chapman wave. You're always looking for at least 4 higher peaks. So they're alphabetized. A is the first. B is the highest, higher peak. That's the second. The third is C. And we always expect at least a fourth higher peak to D. And we're only at C. So I suspect that the XLK could go quite a bit higher as well.
Let's talk about something else that's going on in the market right now. And that's a bit of the safety trade. You've got 10-year treasuries down to about 1.6%. You've got gold holding up strong. And you have things like the utilities that are doing very well. What is that telling you technically?
So on a purely technical basis, using that exact same formula that I was talking about with at least 4 higher peaks in a Chapman wave buy mode, the monthly chart in the TLT, which is the Lehman iShares 20-year Treasury bond ETF, made a high of 148.90 back in August. That's a peak C. I suspect that it will go above 148.90 to go to that leg D. And that probably will coincide with more money coming out of stocks and going into bonds. If the stock market starts to digest gains, that would mean that yields will go lower. So looking out, at this point, I don't have a time frame, but I'm suspecting February or March, we should see 149 area in the TLT. And if that's the case, then over the next 4 to 6 weeks, we should see some consolidation in the market. But as I say, looking out, I still see higher prices for the major indices.
And you're basing that on the fact that your weekly and your monthly models are showing a lot of strength.
In the TLT, I'm looking at strength there, but mostly I'm looking at the major charts of the indices, these very long-term charts, still point to higher highs. And you know, there's something else I mentioned to you the last time we spoke. I said this is probably what in all the years I've been involved in the market, this is the quietest mega bull market that I've ever known. We're at all-time highs. We've done this month after month, year after year. We've had very few really strong pullbacks. There was December a year ago. There was that very sharp decline. But at the same time, when I speak to people, no one's talking to me about the market. They might say, just mention in passing, oh, the market looks good. And they sort of shrug their shoulders or raise their eyebrows. So this is a stealth, quiet bull market, and I suspect most people are very satisfied, especially if they are in indices and they've been long and just holding and not doing any trading. But at the same time, I think there are a lot of traders, and I have a chart that I show that's the IAI. This is the broker-dealer index. It's trading right now at 71.82. The all-time high was a week or so ago at 72.34, so it's within an eye blink of that. And that's with, if brokers are charging fees, they're very little, and many brokers are charging nothing at all. So I think that this is telling us that there are people now involved in the market. There are probably now more people trading shorter term because they must be doing something for the broker index to be up like this. And at the same time, here again, I'm in leg C in the monthly chart of the iShares. I suspect we will still have a peak C, meaning a lower high, and then a new high to a leg D. So even that's looking good. And here on the short term, it was looking very ugly just 3 days ago. Now it's looking not bad at all.
Let's talk about another area of the market that has been struggling, and that has been the commodity sector, especially oil. With oil really breaking down, there's almost been like three breakdowns in the energy sector just since, the last 12 months.
So that's very interesting. Something that I brought up with you last time also was that the TRCCI, which is the Reuters Equal Weight Commodity Index, had been rallying. And in fact, in the daily chart, it made a D at about 420, I think 423, and now it's way down at 399. So that's the overall commodity index. And if you look at crude oil at this particular stage seems to me to be in a trading band. It's at the lower end of the band. If you look at the monthly chart, it's really 66 to maybe 51, 50, somewhere around there. It's just been stuck in that range. So if I put that together with wood, which is this is WOOD, which is the this is the iShares Global Timber and Forestry ETF. It went from 83 back in June of 2018 down to about 51, and that was in I think it was maybe September, and then it ran up to the 67 area, and now it's back down to 63. So if I put that together with high grade copper, the timber and forestry ETF, plus crude oil, that's saying that maybe we are getting some kind of a slowdown economically around the world, but they're all holding okay. They're off their lows. So at this particular point, I think it's reflecting some slowdown, but unless for the United States, that is, unless we really start to break down, if the Dow starts to close under 28,200, I think that will say that we are starting to have that kind of a slowdown here, but I think that that's more reflective of what's happening internationally.
And let's move on to the price of gold, which is, you know, we had a little bit of a pullback, but it's holding its own and still in the uptrend. So where do you see gold going from here? And how does that play with what we're seeing in the safety trade with treasuries and things like utilities?
I'm pleased you mentioned that, because I mentioned to my subscribers the other day, I said, if you look at gold, if you look at crude oil, if you look at the commodity index, if you look at the what's happening in bonds or yields, these all, as you say, this is really what we look at as probably fear gauges. I always think of gold as a fear gauge. And at this particular point, it's just stuck in a range, the previous high of about 1613 and the most recent low in the 1540 area. It's just stuck in the middle there. And I would have thought that with what's happening internationally, certainly with a virus that just we don't know anything about it at this particular point. This is just the start. You would have thought that gold would be part of a fear, some kind of fear factor, but it's holding just steady, and I think that's a good sign. So I think it's trapped at this particular point between 1615 and maybe 1540. If it starts to break out, we'll see it very quickly up in the 1640s. I don't see that right now. And if you look at the dollar is actually also holding very well. It's had a very nice rebound from the recent low of in the 96 area. It hit 98, it's pulling back a little today. I still think that the dollar is reflective of the U.S. economy. I call it like an icon, like Harley Davidson, not the company, but just the icon internationally of Harley. And I think the dollar is in that. It's the currency of demand, I think, right now. So it's holding very well. So if you put that together, you can see why gold is probably not breaking out. And funnily enough, gold went up a little bit, but at the same time as the dollar. It isn't very often that gold and the dollar, they usually are opposite. I always think of the counterpoint of Bach, going one melody going one way and the harmony going the other. In this particular instance, you've got them in narrow ranges. So to me, it's more what happens with the prices. In other words, if the stock market, if the indices over the next week or two make all-time highs, I think that would be very different. That'll start to say that if you didn't buy every single dip, you look very foolish when you look back. And that'll force people into it. And I've called this a silent bull market. But I think the next big breakout to the upside will have people a lot more vocal. And I've always thought that the reason why people don't talk about the stock market is it might have a political connotation. Nobody wants to get into any political discussions, so they don't even mention the stock market. That's just my impression.
So if you have some key markers here, and you mentioned 28,200 on the Dow, that could be a vulnerable.
Yes.
Any other markers that you're watching that would tip you off as to which direction this goes?
So what I'm saying here is if the Dow starts to close under 28,200, that would imply for me that the daily chart is starting to break down, and that'll almost certainly start to impact the weekly chart, which, as I say, technically is still very strong right now. So that would be a very important marker for me. On the S&P, the most recent level is 3234. That was just 4 days ago. If we start to see the S&P trading, it can't just bounce below and then have a rebound. It needs to close. If it closes under 3230, I think that would be reflective of very weak technicals in the daily chart, and that will start to impact the weekly. And the weekly is at a peak D, so I've got to watch this very closely, because at the next level will be 3198 on the S&P weekly chart, 14-period moving average support. And on the QQQ, which, as I say, is the Index 100 trading vehicle, the close, it's at 224 right now. The low of just 4 days ago was 217.28. And I would say if it closes under 215, that would start to be very negative for the daily. And so far, the technicals on the daily are holding very nicely. So it's that weekly chart. And we've got a little doji candle from last week. So what happens between now and, I'd say, Monday would be very important, because let's say Amazon comes out, instead of having a huge move up, it's actually a pullback. And that would reflect on the market itself. And let me just say, I think actually as we speak, maybe earnings are out. Oh, look at that. Earnings are out, and it's up 170 points at 2027. The all-time high was 2050. So that's going to be, if it, we don't know what happens when they have the call, and we don't know what happens between now and tomorrow. We saw that with Apple, it was up huge, and then it wasn't down, but it was a little weaker today. So that's going to be very important. And we've got, I'd say that Amazon is probably going to be very important, because it'll be telling us a lot about the economy, because, you know, this involves deliveries. It just involves so much. So I would say if Amazon starts to make a new all-time high over the next couple of days, that's going to be very positive. So those are the levels. So what to me is very important to be watching support levels. If they break, that's going to be meaningful. At the moment, as I say, weekly charts are still pretty good.
As we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, you do a lot of things. Why don't you tell our listeners how they can find out more about what you do?
So I have a newsletter called The Opening Call. It's at tfnn.tigerfinancialnewsnetwork. And I also have a show between noon Eastern time and 1 p.m. It's a call-in show on the stock market. And every market day, Monday through Friday, as I say, noon to 1 p.m., it's called the Tiger Technician's Hour. And I love to take calls from people. So tfnn.com is where they can go to find out a lot more.
All right. Well, Basil, as always, pleasure having you on the program. Happy New Year and all the best. Come back and talk to us again.
Thank you very much, Jim. Same to you.
James Garris, the publisher of the Browning World Climate Bulletin, joined us on FS Insider to discuss a large range of different economic impacts from weather. Not only what we saw in 2019 with a number of billion-dollar weather and climate-related disasters, but also what he's seeing already for the start of this year in 2020. We also discussed what's happening in Australia, how this is going to factor into the political discussion of climate change, enhanced regulations, a lot of interesting topics that we discussed in our interview with James Garris. Here is a clip of what he had to tell listeners.
So because of these new regulations that are being discussed and considered, I'm not going to be too surprised if we see the Australian wildfires being used as the leverage point to start implementing new regulations into organizations that would be able to implement it on a more global basis. It doesn't necessarily mean that every entity, every country will follow them. And some countries, China, the United States, India, are large enough economies that threats by the United Nations may not have as much validation as, say, Chile or Namibia or Belgium, which are smaller economies and a little bit more at the toe of that impact. We'll have to keep an eye out and see what's going to happen with this over the next 6 to 8 months. But climate change, environmental policies, it's going to be a talking point. You're going to see it daily in newspapers, on the internet. It'll be talked about heavily in the U.S. presidential debates and will be discussed thoroughly by leaders from a variety of countries. It's not going to be an if. It will definitely be a when we start seeing some of these changes take place.
So if you want to hear this full interview and aren't already a subscriber to FS Insider, which airs 3 days a week with book authors, investment strategists, and industry experts, all you have to do is go to financialsense.com and click where it says subscribe.
Should you buy and hold at market tops? At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we believe valuations, leading economic indicators, and other metrics are essential for prudent investing to both identify long-term opportunities and to minimize risk. Every day, we keep a watchful eye on the markets, continually assessing the investment landscape so you can focus on the things that matter most. Don't put your hard-earned wealth at risk. Give us a call at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA and SIPC. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, a registered investment advisor.
One of the certainties on life, we've all been told, is death and taxes. And that's what we're going to be talking about on today's program. But more importantly, the history of taxes. Joining me on the program is Dominic Frisby. He's written a new book called Daylight Robbery, How Tax Shaped Our Past and Will Change Our Future. Dominic, just out of curiosity, can you explain for our listeners, what was the genesis of this book?
Well, it's you're going to be surprised to hear this, Jim, but your program was the cause of this book. I bet you didn't.
I'll be darned.
Because I've always been a keen listener to your show, and what a pleasure it is to be talking to you. And this would have been probably around about the time of the financial crisis, maybe even a year or two before or a year or two after, you know, so at least 10 years ago. I remember you hearing you talk once about this fantastic book by Charles Adams, who is a tax historian, called Fight, Fright, or Fraud, The Impact of Taxes on the Course of Civilization. And I thought, oh, that sounds interesting. And it's out of print now in the UK, that book. And it was about 5 or 6 years before I eventually stumbled across it. And then when I read it, as soon as I read, you know, half the book, or not even that, half of the first chapter, I instantly knew that I needed to write a book about this same subject. Because as soon as you start to look at life through this perspective of taxes, and when I say life, I mean at history, at the past, at the present, and at the future, suddenly so much becomes clear. Why things happened as they did, why things are as they are now, and how things are going to be in the future. And it amazes me that more people don't look at the world through this perspective of taxes, because, you know, as Benjamin Franklin said, and many others besides, taxes, you know, are as inevitable as death. And there has never been a civilization without taxation. The first taxes were enacted in ancient Mesopotamia, and probably this sense of duty to the greater collective existed in you know, the hunter-gatherer societies that preceded civilization. So, you know, taxes as old as we are.
You know, in your book, in the intro, you describe the tax cycle. And I want to read from this for our listeners, because I think they'll be able to relate to this. And it is enacted at a time of need, usually to fund some kind of war. It is presented as temporary, but becomes permanent. The amount payable is low at first, but increases over time. It violates basic freedoms, in this case, the right to light and fresh air. Many go to great lengths to avoid paying it, and it thus distorts how people behave and the decisions they make. There are all sorts of unintended consequences, which get worse as the tax matures. Much of the money raised is wasted or spent in a way which the taxpayer does not agree. Finally, people have had enough, and there is some kind of movement, a campaign, a protest, even a revolution, to get rid of it, which government is slow and reluctant to do. How true is that, Dominic? I thought that was beautifully written.
Well, I mean, that's the sort of the life cycle of a tax. And, you know, in this case, I was talking about the window tax, which we had in Europe. You got away with it in America. You never had it. But this was a tax that was enacted when we had a thing in 1688 in the UK called the Glorious Revolution, where the Catholic monarch James II was overthrown and replaced with a Protestant king, William. Well, it was William and Mary. They were the monarchs, and Mary was actually James's sister or daughter, I forget which. But William was William of Orange, and he'd come over from Holland. And so in order to ingratiate himself with the newly conquered people, they had this idea of getting rid of a tax. And so we paid in those days hearth taxes, and a tax inspector would come to your house and demand to count the number of fireplaces in your home. And this would happen twice a year, and you would then have to pay a tax for every fireplace you had. And the English hated it. It was considered a violation of their privacy. And so in order to ingratiate the newly conquered, the monarchs with the newly conquered people, they got rid of the tax. But then within about two or three years, you know, William's waging wars on the continent, he's got no money. And he's like, guys, we need a tax here. We need to raise some money, because hearth money had been the government's largest source of revenue. And so they struck upon this idea of taxing windows instead of fireplaces, because you could walk past somebody's house and count the number of windows they had. And, you know, you didn't have to interact with the taxpayer. There was no violation of privacy. And so, and it became a very lucrative source of revenue for the government. And of course, the amounts were very low at first, but as time went by, more and more people, you know, the amounts levied grew bigger and bigger. And that tax lasted 170 years. And it was a terrible, terrible tax, because what it did is one of the many unintended consequences. The way it distorted behavior is, in order to avoid paying the tax, people started blocking up their windows. In the Industrial Revolution, all the outbreaks of disease in the cities were made far worse by these cramped, damp, windowless dwellings. And of course, the people who suffered most were the poor. And you know, there was no electricity in those days. There wasn't even gas lighting. People used reeds and rushlights. And so to sacrifice their fresh air was no small sacrifice. And there were campaigns against it. Charles Dickens hated it. There was all scientific studies showed how this tax was actually killing people. And the government went on and on and on. And eventually, when the matter was eventually debated in Parliament, legend has it that MPs cried out, "Daylight robbery." And that's where we get the expression from, the window tax. And so you see that cycle of taxes in the window tax, but you could apply the same thing to income tax. You know, income tax was enacted at a time of need to fund the First World, well, in the case of Britain, to fund the Napoleonic Wars, but it was enacted in 1913, very small amounts to replace tariffs. And then suddenly World War One comes along, it goes up. World War Two comes along, you get the 1942 Revenue Act. Prior to 1942, ordinary Americans paid no income tax whatsoever. It was presented as temporary, but it never, you know, income tax was first enacted in 1799 in the UK, and it was presented as temporary. And here we are, and it hasn't gone away. But it only affected the rich. But now everyone pays huge amounts of income tax. And, you know, if you said roughly everything you earn, roughly 50% of everything you ever earn over the course of your life is taken from you in taxes. It's a little bit less in America than it is in Europe, but it's roughly 50%. And if you said 50% of everything you ever earn to somebody who lived 100 years ago, they'd go, "You're mad." But that's that's where we are.
And it could get worse. I want to talk about how taxes can be very successful and create a lot of prosperity. In your book, you talk about, I believe his name is John Copperthwaite. He was an Englishman.
Scotsman.
That was sent over, Scotsman, sent to Hong Kong in 1945 to set up economic policies. And it was interesting because in your book, you draw the contrast. Hong Kong's tax policies were the polar opposite of those pursued by Britain over the same time. When Britain and most of the West had high levels of taxation, government spending, deficit financing, industrial planning, and economic intervention, Hong Kong went the other way. It started as a small little colony somewhat and became a very prosperous and financial center. And most of that, Dominic, was due to its tax policies.
Well, I mean, the tax policies provided the framework and the platform. But, you know, the extraordinary growth that Hong Kong has experienced is because its people are hardworking and entrepreneurial and clever and all those things that you need to be successful. But they were certainly encouraged to be that way by the tax system. This chap, John James Cowperthwaite or Cooperthwaite, depending, it's different people pronounce it in different ways. It's a very funny story because he was this Scot who had gone to St. Andrews University and his lecturer at university was obsessed with Adam Smith. And sort of he gave this same love of Adam Smith to Cowperthwaite. And it was said that Cowperthwaite would sleep with a copy of Wealth of Nations by his bed. And he was sent over. And the irony of this is that Hong Kong was a colony. It wasn't a democracy. But England was so wrapped up in its post-war, Britain was so wrapped up in its post-war self, it just let Hong Kong get on with it. Cowperthwaite was sent out there. And in 1945, and one of the things he had to do was encourage business. And he just used to walk around the streets and looked at what was going on. And he thought, these people don't need encouraging. They can just get on with it by themselves. Over the course of the next 50 years, say, Hong Kong experienced unbelievable economic growth. If you think that in 1945, the population was just 600,000 people and its per capita GDP was on a level with most of Africa. It was about $200 or $300. Within a generation and a half, and it was about maybe a fifth of what England's per capita GDP was, and even a smaller fraction of US GDP. By the late 1980s, its per capita GDP is higher than Britain. And in the late 1990s, it overtook the US. And today, it's like the third or fourth richest nation in the world. It's got its per capita GDP is almost twice the UK's. It has the best health service in the world. Its transport system is the best in the world. Its education is incredible. So it's not like on the supply side, people lose out. You know, Hong Kong's among, in all the international schools tests, Hong Kong's always in the top five. And tax as a percentage of GDP never exceeded 14%, 1/4.
Wow.
You know, and that's 14%. And if you think, you know, the tradition, the Christian tradition, but it's not just a Christian tradition, it's virtually every religion has this idea of the tithe, the tenth. You pay a tenth of what you earn, you give to your Lord who gives you protection and he provide alms for the poor and so on. And this tenth is a, you know, it's a number that goes all the way back to ancient Mesopotamia. And Hong Kong was roughly, you know, at 14%, that's not far off the tithe. And there was no income tax except for the very rich. And something like 40% of Hong Kong's tax revenue came from land taxes, taxes on the rental value of land. So they didn't tax labor, they taxed wealth. And it was extraordinarily successful.
You know, in your book, you write something, and this kind of brings us up to where we are today. And you say, the large state social democratic model by which we currently live, with government the main provider of welfare, education, healthcare, and other essential services, is in jeopardy and may even be within a generation. Many nation states, as we currently know them, will no longer exist. Tax will be at the heart of it all. Tax will determine what follows. Explain that.
Well, wow, what a question. But you're absolutely right. I did say it, so I've got to answer it. The reason that the large state democratic model by which we currently operate is in jeopardy is simply because government spending so far exceeds government revenue. And government make up for it with debt. And debt is, of course, a tax on the future. They also make up for it by what Milton Friedman called taxation without legislation, the inflation tax. They debase the value of their money to debase the value of their obligations. But basically, governments in their current form cannot continue to supply the services they do, and unless they put up tax. But it's almost impossible to put up taxes unless there is some kind of crisis. The evidence is of throughout history, whenever governments, leaders, rulers try to put up taxes in times of peace, it fails. You need an emergency. The last example of this we had was 2008, quantitative easing. That was, I call it the inflation tax, but it was, you need some kind of emergency to implement these things. And wars are the best example. And you know, there's this odd relationship in history between war and tax, in that every war is funded by some kind of tax. You cannot have war unless you have tax. And the tax is raised during the event and also through debt, and then often by taxing the newly conquered nations in the case of old-fashioned war. You plunder and then you tax. So, but at the same time, you can't have war without tax, but you can't have tax without war, if you see what I mean. So anyway, governments, to come back to the initial point, governments have got these extraordinary obligations. And we've got this sort of two-tier economy where the laborer, the worker, pays the vast share of tax. And if you look at the global super rich, the so-called 1% and so on, they pay very little income tax because most of them don't rely on their labor for their income. Their wealth derives from the appreciation in the value of their companies, their real estate, their stocks, their shares, and so on, which for the most part go untaxed unless you pay capital gains tax. There isn't this sort of constant taxing that exists with income tax. So the economy is very geared against the laborer. And 50% of government revenue worldwide derives from income tax. But the nature of employment is changing. Now, if you think maybe half a generation ago, you know, people had a job with a company for life, or they might change company two or three times in their life. The reality is of now is that more and more people are becoming freelancers, the gig economy, contingent workers. These are all different names for the same thing. And Ernst & Young have estimated that by 2030, half of the US workforce will be contingent. That's an extraordinary number. Now, contingent workers, freelancers, are much, much harder to tax because you cannot deduct the money at source. And all the evidence shows that freelancers doing the same job as ordinary workers pay much lower levels of tax. They find more expenses to write off. There's much more scope for non-compliance and so on. So just as government obligations are getting that much greater, their finances on the other side are going to be squeezed. And many governments, of course, as we know, we've been talking about this for years, but many governments are going to go bankrupt. And as a result, you know, the nature of the nation state that we know today will change. Borders will change. Governments will fall. Many countries will split up and divide. We're already seeing this, you know, in Europe now. Catalonia wants independence from Spain. The UK, Brexit is taking place as we speak. So all these factors just mean that this social democratic model by which most of the developed world lives, I just think 50 years from now, it won't exist.
You know, you went on further in your book and you touched upon something that Charles Adams did. And in your chapter on Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, many people are unaware that Islam spread rapidly. A lot of that had to do with their tax policy. Explain that, because our listeners may not be aware of it.
Yeah, well, I wasn't aware of it. And it's amazing. But, you know, one of my theories in the book is that behind every great event in history, there is some kind of tax story, without which that events would have unfolded very differently. And I do this thing when I'm talking on stage, I get the audience to shout out great events from history, and I endeavor to tell them the tax story behind that event. And of course, every war was funded by tax, every conquest was about taking control of the tax base, the land, the labor, the produce, the profit. But even extraordinarily, like things like the Great Wall of China, we think the Great Wall of China was built to keep the Mongol hordes out, but it wasn't. It was built to collect duties on goods coming along the Silk Road, as much as it was to keep out the Mongol hordes. So, you know, there's always a tax story there. And of course, it was built with tax money and tax labor. But in the case of all the great religions, well, firstly, Mary and Joseph were in Bethlehem for a census, for Augustus's census or to pay tax. If they hadn't been there, if Augustus Caesar hadn't levied that tax, Mary and Joseph would never have been in Bethlehem, and Christianity would never have unfolded in the way that it did. And the crime for which Jesus was eventually crucified was forbidding to give tribute. In other words, telling people not to pay their taxes. And in the case of Islam, early Islam, just saw this incredible growth. In the space of 30 or 40 years, it went from a tiny little bit of Saudi Arabia to most of North Africa and most of the Middle East. And people wonder how it is that it was able to spread so quickly. And Islam had this wonderful tax policy, the Islamic conquerors, is that they were going into areas, you know, the Sasanian Empire, the Persian Empire, the Roman Empire, all of which the citizens had been incredibly heavily taxed. And in many cases, they welcomed the Islamic invaders. And the Islamic invaders had this simple tax policy, which was convert to Islam and you won't have to pay the poll tax. If you don't convert to Islam, you do have to pay the poll tax. And if you don't pay the poll tax, we'll kill you. So it was a very simple choice, death, taxes, or Islam. And for obvious reasons, many people chose Islam. And that, so it was, again, low tax policy enabled this incredibly rapid expansion of the Islamic Empire. 30, 40 years it took over all that territory. And the weird thing is low taxes inspire loyalty in the people. Heavily taxed regimes have very little, people feel very little loyalty, but low tax regimes, whether it's the early Roman Republic or Britain in the 19th century or America in the early 20th century, low tax regimes or Islam then, low tax regimes inspire loyalty in the people.
Dominic, I want to go on to the next chapter, which you talked about how Black Death changed the tax structure of Europe. And you were basically talking about feudalism, because at the top was the king. He had all the rights. His rule was supposed to be given from God. He owned all the land, which was the primary source of wealth back then. He kept some for himself and some for the church and then some for his barons. And at the bottom, you had the serfs. What I found is, I think many people would find interesting, we all heard about serfdom and how tough it was, but the average serf only worked 3 out of a 7-day week to pay the lord. The rest was for himself. You compare that to tax structures today, they're actually much higher than serfdom.
Well, it's a comparison I make in that in terms of time, how much of the average worker's time is spent working for himself and how much is spent working for his lord, which in today's world is the government. On a time basis, the lot of today's worker is the same as the medieval serf. But obviously conditions, for the most part, for today's worker are rather better than they were for the medieval serf. We have a lot more luxuries than they did back then. But yeah, I mean, feudalism is an odd one because they didn't actually call it feudalism at the time. It was only began to be referred to as feudalism, you know, by historians several hundred years later. But as you say, the king was at the top, and in exchange, he'd give land to his barons in exchange for their loyalty and for their knights and for their men and for a share of their produce. And this sort of that chain went all the way down to serfs at the bottom. What changed it all? And it was basically a system of tax. You know, it wasn't, taxes weren't always paid in money. Taxes were paid in labor. They were paid in a share of your produce, you know, share of the harvest, a share of your, you know, if you slaughtered an animal, you would have to, if you had grain, you would have to go to the Lord's granary and then he would take some of your grain. If you slaughtered an animal, some of it went to your superior, and so forth. But the Black Death came along and wiped out something like 60 to 70% of the European population. And suddenly, the value of a serf's labor dramatically increased because there just were not enough serfs to work the land after the Black Death died out. So on a relative basis, the value of land fell and the value of a serf's labor increased. So many lords offered their serfs their freedom and paid them money to keep them on the land. And so for the first time, serfs were handling money. The powers that be hated this new class, and they had all sorts of sumptuary laws they introduced that tried to regulate how they dressed and the food that they ate. They didn't want them eating good food like their superiors. They didn't want them dressing like superiors. There were all sorts of laws to try and keep this upwardly mobile class down. But the other thing it gave us was lots of poll taxes. In fact, one of the reasons we have surnames, certainly in Western Europe, is, you know, in the 12th and 13th century, people didn't have surnames. But when once poll taxes came in, people needed surnames in order to identify them for tax purposes. So there would be John the Smith, as opposed to John Jack's son. So, you know, it would either be defined by their job or by their paternity, or, you know, John Mack is another paternity one, or the Irish O is another paternity one, or you'd be defined by some geographical feature that was where you live, John Hill, John Ford, something like that. And then in Gaelic cultures, you were often defined by your characteristics. So Kennedy, for example, means helmet or shaggy head, according to some things, or Cameron means crooked nose, or Connolly means valiant. So that surnames came around because of taxes. But anyway, the Black Death wiped out this new feudal class. And then over the course of the next 100 years, you know, serfdom just gradually died away. And this new working class started to pay poll taxes and other forms of taxes. And we got the Peasants Revolt, which is one of the great stories in English history. We won't tell it here, but you'll have to read the book.
Well, let's just kind of summarize some of those things, because we saw the Civil War, the war between King Charles I and Cromwell, which ended up with the king's execution, which ended the divine right of kings. And the king was subject to law like everyone else. And then, of course, we get to our own American Revolution, which kind of started and had its genesis in tax.
Do you know what really interesting about the American Revolution was that the American revolutionaries believed they weren't fighting for new rights. They were fighting for their rights that had been enshrined in Magna Carta several hundred years before. And Magna Carta was the result of another war over tax between, you know, the barons felt that King John was taxing them too much, which he was. And he was, a lot of that taxes was false. There was, and, you know, he was saying he needed the money for war. I mean, King John was one of the most ruthless tax collectors in history. That's where we get the legend of Robin Hood. But Magna Carta, 500 years, was a sort of treaty at the end of the Barons' War drawn up between John and the barons. It was basically a tax document. And then that was the thing that the American Revolutions, when they cried no taxation without representation, they thought they were fighting for rights enshrined in Magna Carta. It's amazing how these little things impact society 500 years later.
You know, what was interesting, and once again, we're looking at history, you have a part in your book on Louis the 14th, who ruled France for, gosh, almost 7 decades. And he was on his deathbed. And he said to his heir, "Do not follow the bad example which I have set for you. I have often undertaken war too lightly and have sustained it for vanity. Do not imitate me, but be a peaceful prince. And may you apply yourself principally to the alleviation of the burdens of your subjects." Of course, we all know he left his country's finances in a perilous condition. In fact, it sort of went well for a couple of years, but then eventually we had the kind of hyperinflation with John Law. And of course, eventually with taxation, we got the French Revolution right around the same time of the American Revolution.
Yeah, it was about 20 years later, but for sure, well, actually, no, less than that. And funnily enough, one of the reasons that the French were paying so much taxes at the time of the French Revolution is that they'd been raising taxes to fund the American revolutionaries to fight the English in North America. But yeah, I mean, the French Revolution it was one of the most punitive tax regimes in Europe at the time, and salt taxes and any number of, at one point, peasants were paying 5 different taxes on wine on, you know, at different stages. And, you know, you can imagine a tax on wine in France, how popular that was. And so, you know, it eventually resulted in the French Revolution. And the beautiful story is when Napoleon eventually rode through the cities of Paris, the newly emperor who was going to fix everything in post-revolutionary France, the crowds cried, "Plus d'impôts, à bas des riches, à pas la République. Vive l'empereur," which literally translates as "no more taxes, down with the rich, down with the Republic, long live the emperor." So, yeah. So French was a good one. And then, well, I think you might be about to ask me about this, but we'll come to that in a moment. The English Civil War, of course, was a war about who controlled the tax revenue, the crown or parliament. And parliament eventually won. And that was the sort of the end of the monarchy in Britain as the sort of number one power force. power source.
You know, it's rather interesting reading your book. You bring up so many things behind some of the great historical events that we have seen and studied throughout history, from the French Revolution, the American Revolution, and even fast forward to the Civil War here in the United States, where a lot of it was based on the tariffs that the North wanted to protect its up-and-coming manufacturing sector at the expense of the South. So even there, we had taxes, and moving all the way forward, whether it was the Russian Revolution, World War I, and World War II, one of the things you talked about in your book, Dominic, that normally to fight wars, they're expensive. Kings, emperors, presidents, prime ministers have to raise tax to pay for them. But interesting, as you point out, after the war is over, they may reduce taxes a little bit, but they never come down to where they were before. I mean, most people would die to find out that in World War II, taxes in the U.S. were 94%. And I think you mentioned in Britain, they were 97.5%.
Yeah, for the very rich, they were at the top level. It was all tiered. That's why we have this large government model that we have today. Two world wars, they allowed for higher taxes. And then after the war, the government has incurred a lot of obligations during the war. It's got debts to pay. It's got bombed cities to rebuild. It's got the wounded to look after. It's got an economy to regalvanize. And taxes never go back to the level they were before the emergency started. The Institute of Fiscal Studies here in the UK calls it the ratchet effect. But it's basically those two world wars gave us this large state model by which we live today. Could I ask you a question, Jim, as an American?
Sure.
I spend a lot of time talking about the American Civil War and the sort of, we're taught in the UK that that was a war over slavery and that, that was the main issue in that war. And then reading about the history of the Civil War, it seems that slavery was a big issue at the time, but it wasn't the actual cause of the war. It wasn't the reason the Southern states, the Southern states were paying something like 90% of it was a factor. Everyone was protecting their economic interests. But the overriding reason why the Southern states wanted secession is that they felt they were paying 90% of federal taxes, but not those taxes weren't being spent in the South. They were being spent in the North. So they weren't seeing any benefit for their taxes. And it was fine when the cotton price was high, but it wasn't so good when the cotton price was low. Is that a story you've heard before? Is that a well-known story in America, or is that sort of fairly niche?
That's a niche perspective. If you go to school, you're taught about slavery as a cause for the Civil War. And it wasn't, Dominic, until I read Charles Adams' book that I really discovered the true issue, as in your book, behind the Civil War, which dealt with tariffs and taxes, because that's not what you're taught in school. You're taught, basically, it was a slavery and race issue. But you won't find that in a textbook. I want to move on and talk about, you mentioned, as we just spoke, about how during these wars, taxes are raised. We mentioned 94 here and 97.5% in England. They never go back down because all of a sudden you have basically a big state apparatus, and it's reluctant to give up some of that power. And they've come up with various forms of taxes. Probably the easiest is the income tax with employers. But I want to move on to sort of another type of tax that people don't talk about. And the reason I'm bringing this up is I think this is going to be one of the big issues of this upcoming decade. And that is debt and taxation with inflation. Because one of the hidden taxes that get a lot of people, and we don't measure it properly, because in California, everywhere you look, they're adding another tax. They just added a climate change tax to restaurants, and the government doesn't measure that. But let's talk about some of the hidden taxes, because one of the easiest ways for the government to get rid of its debt is to inflate it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. And starting with inflation, but, debt and inflation, there's so much crossover between the two because excess debt usually leads to inflation. But, inflation isn't measured properly. The original definition of inflation was you inflate, either, in other words, you blow up the money supply, and the consequence of blowing up the money supply is higher prices. Now, inflation just means higher prices. And there are all sorts of measures of inflation, but they only measure one small part of the economy. In the UK, it's something like our inflation measures measure the effect of something like 13% of money supply growth. They don't measure the effect of inflation on house prices, on asset prices, on financial asset prices. They just measure the effect of inflation on a small basket of consumer goods, which are themselves prone to the deflationary forces of increased and improved production. And so, you know, the measures of inflation are totally misleading. But Milton Friedman called it taxation without legislation. And it's insidious. It really is insidious because people don't know, they don't realize it's going on. And Nicholas Copernicus called inflation insidious, and it's insidious because it's hidden. Keynes said it happens in a way not one man in a million is able to diagnose. It's like the ultimate stealth tax. And one of the ways they keep it stealthy is by not measuring it properly. And then suddenly the price of goods and services is getting more and more expensive every year, and your wages, meanwhile, aren't getting any higher, and people can't understand why they permanently feel the squeeze. But it's like it's relentless every year, 4-5%, 4-5%, and the cumulative effect of that, you know, the compounding of that over many years is why we see these graphs of the pound or the US dollar over the last 100 years, and they've lost 95, 98, 99% of their purchasing power. And I'm sure over the next 100 years, they'll use another 95 or 98%.
You know, I want to talk about something you had mentioned earlier in this interview, and that's where we find ourselves today. We have the gig economy, as Ernst & Young talked about, you know, over a third or more by the end of this decade. And if you take a look at the way taxes are collected right now, they're collected when you buy stuff at the store, the sales tax. They're collected if you own a home, the property tax. And if you have a job, they're collected through withholding tax, the income tax. But the world is changing. Technologically, corporations, big ones like Apple, Google, multinational, can move and shift what they pay in taxes all around the globe. And let's talk about how this is coming to the gig economy and the difficulty it's going to raise in collecting taxes in the future, because tax revenue base will not be as secure.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting. The nature of the gig economy, and you've got to particularly focus on the digital economy. All the growth is in the digital economy. If you look at the growth in Silicon Valley that's taken place in between, say, 1990 and today, I think the market cap of the three biggest companies is something like 60 times higher. And that's extraordinary. But at the same time, those three biggest companies employ about a quarter of as many people as they did in 1990. But that's not to say, you know, Google employs fewer people, Facebook employs fewer people, Apple employs fewer people than the three biggest companies did in 1990. But there's loads of people who make a living using Google, you know, whether it's YouTubers or, you know, there's loads of people who earn their money thanks to Google and Facebook and so on, but they're not actually employees of the company. So there's this extraordinary growth, you know, as we talked about with freelancers, people working freelance. The other thing we're going to see the growth of with freelancers is what's called digital nomads. Now, if you think how hard governments have found it to tax the tech giants, you know, they put their intellectual property in one place, their copyright in another place, they pay corporation tax in Ireland. There are all these means by which they juggle their assets around, and governments haven't been able to tax it because essentially the digital economy is a cross-border economy. It's, you know, the internet has no borders, and governments had just not found a way to tax it effectively. But what happens when workers become as digital as these companies? Because that's what's going to happen. More and more digital nomads, more and more people. You know, it's something like there's a chap called Peter Levels who's done a study on this, and he estimates that the global workforce in 2035, so 15 years from now, will be 6 billion people in a global population of 9 billion. 6 billion workers worldwide. A billion of those, so one-sixth of workers, will be digital nomads, traveling from country to country, working in the digital economy. Who do they pay tax to? You know, let's say I'm in Thailand and I get offered a job for a company in Brazil. I then go off to the Philippines where I actually do the job. I send it over the internet. You know, the globalized economy of the internet is very, very difficult to tax. And you know, how do you control and regulate it if the work is taking place in jurisdictions over which you have no control? It's a big, big problem that governments are going to have. And I'm delighted that they're going to have this problem, I must say. As a result, the digital economy will see far greater growth than the physical economy will, because one of the things that holds the physical economy back is very high levels of taxes. And so if one economy is being taxed and the other economy isn't being taxed, you know where the growth's going to be.
You know, let's talk about, in addition to this new gig economy and the difficult for taxation, let's talk about the threat of cryptocurrencies to governments, number one. And number two, governments getting more ruthless. In fact, we've got, you see this in the media all the time, of what they call tax shaming. You will find out that somebody didn't pay their taxes or is getting away with sheltering their taxes, and they're made into a media spectacle. A good example is some of the president's cabinet that got tried not for anything to do with the election, but for tax evasion, and they're in prison.
Yeah, well, this is a very interesting dynamic. So the first thing is that already 50% of digital nomads work in some capacity in the crypto economy. That's not to say they're all trading bitcoins or whatever, but at some point they receive or make payment using cryptocurrency. And you talk to the CEOs of some of these companies that have got employees in multiple jurisdictions. It's a borderless company. The easiest way to pay them is with borderless money. And, you know, you don't have to get involved in all the foreign exchange and all the charges. You just simply pay them in Bitcoin or Bitcoin Cash or whatever it is. And once again, one reason that governments have such control is that they control the money supply, they control money. But cryptocurrencies are much harder for them to control and regulate. So the more that people, particularly workers and economies, start using borderless money, that's the way the economy of the internet's going. Even if it's Facebook's coin, Libra coin, you know, I just see huge growth for Libra coin, despite the fact that, you know, regulators hate it. But if everyone's using Libra coin, there aren't the same ways of controlling and regulating it that you can impose, you know, on the banking system by people using US dollars in the United States or people using sterling in the UK. It's just, you know, there's just so much more scope for non-compliance. So that's one big issue. But, you know, there's two schools of thought. There's the sort of libertarian worldview that thinks government should be much smaller and individual responsibility should be much greater. But there's a huge school of thought, which is a much more authoritarian left-wing school of thought, which thinks everyone should pay taxes and taxes should be higher and the rich should pay taxes. And, you know, the beauty of the internet is it's the most fantastic research tool, but tax shaming, and you've got these brilliant journalists. There was the Panama Papers a couple of years ago. They exposed all these people who are using offshore bank accounts. You've got these, you know, very clever people of a left-wing authoritarian worldview who are, you know, will try and expose people for non-payment of tax. And government's revenue is going to be, there's going to be a squeeze on government finances, as we've discussed. And so they will get more aggressive in their collection of taxes, and they will clamp down on where they're actually able to collect taxes, which is the sort of physical real world economy. The borderless world of the internet will be much harder. So once again, this sort of two-tier society will emerge of, you know, what William Rees-Mogg called the sovereign individuals who are borderless and pay low levels of taxes. And then, you know, people for whatever reason stuck in their country in a physical economy who will pay high levels. And you're actually going to see cities designed to attract nomadic workers. There's already cities being built in China. You know, there will be all sorts of tax breaks and whatever to attract these workers and their wealth. But this is the world we're going into, a much more borderless world. Air travel's getting cheaper. That's another in 5G all across the world. All these things will just make the workforce much more digital and harder to control, tax, and regulate.
Towards the end of the book, you mentioned Adam Smith's book, The Wealth of Nations, and he had four principles that he outlined I wish politicians would learn for a tax system. One, it should be fair. Two, it should be clear and plain to the contributor, which neither our system. I'm going through a tax certification program myself, and the thing that really strikes me, Dominic, is how complex the U.S. tax system has become. And then, you know, two of the other things are taxes should be levied at the time or in a manner which is most likely to be convenient for the contributor to pay. And fourth, suggested that taxes should cost as little as possible to collect.
Yeah, the four canons of taxation. That's absolutely right. Adam Smith's four canons. And yeah, if only you talk about how complex the American tax system is. You know, the UK has the longest tax code in the entire world. It's more than 20 million words. Now, to put that number in some kind of context, that is 14 times the length of the Bible, or 14 times all of the Harry Potter books combined. I mean, it's just extraordinary. And it's more than most people read in their entire lifetime. But not only is it long, it's written in a language that's in many cases unreadable. And, you know, some people have the resources to find the loopholes and exploit them. Other people don't. And the end result is inequality. You know, it's just ridiculous, our tax systems. And yet, I don't really know that much about American tax reform. But in the UK, we haven't had a chancellor for a generation who's committed to fewer and lower taxes. Who even looks after the American tax code?
Well, I tell you, it's a great industry because you have tax accountants, you have congresspeople that are always handing out special provisions for people that contribute to their campaign. I mean, it's very quite complex. You mentioned something in your book I find rather interesting, and that is eventually this mountain of debt. I think the U.S. is now close to $24 trillion, that eventually we're going to see the death of the nation state for various reasons, technology, the gig economy, digital economy. And you talk about towards the end, the governments get more ruthless, a wealth tax, which brings us to the 2020 election, because two of the leading candidates want to raise tax rates with an annual wealth tax, some of the things that you talked about in your book.
Yeah, there's a lot of sympathy, particularly in the alienated young. You know, the asset light generation have been priced out and they can't afford a house and they can't understand why. And it's a big, big problem. You know, I don't see the breakup of the United States, but it's worth remembering that, you know, the United States is such a young nation, and it was just really a marriage. It was really lots of separate states, and they just sort of, you know, married post-revolution because it was a sort of relationship of convenience. But in Europe, on the one hand, there's this sort of move towards a European superstate. But, you know, here in the UK, for example, Scotland, the majority of Scotland wants to be part of the EU. And the majority of England doesn't want to be part of the EU. Now, if Scotland said, doesn't look like they're going to get a referendum, but, you know, they could, the case for them having another referendum so that Scotland can rejoin the EU, even if England doesn't want to be a part of it, is very strong. And then immediately the United Kingdom's broken up. We tend to think of nation states, we're born with them and we're used to them, but they're actually a relatively recent model, you know, 150, 200 years. And, you know, even something like Yugoslavia, Yugoslavia was broke up into four or five or six different Balkan nations in the 90s. And I just think many countries, there's so much political discontent, but there is also, you know, that can be dealt with. But when there's political discontent and bankruptcy, you know, many nation states are bankrupt. And once they lose control of their tax base, it's game over.
What's rather interesting about this is you take where the U.S. is now, where we have $24 trillion in debt. And Dominic, we just ran a $1 trillion deficit with the lowest unemployment in over a half a century. The economy still growing at 2%. So where does this put us if we ever get into a recession? And yet in this election, you have, I call it the lots of free stuff that other people pay for election. Because, you know, it's free college, forgiveness of loans, medical for everyone. All the things that people are promising, or at least some of the candidates, we don't have the money to pay for that.
No. I tell you what's coming, which is there's a thing called green quantitative easing, which is basically quantitative easing to fund green projects. There's this another movement in the UK for the people's quantitative easing. So instead of the money going into the central bank to buy financial assets, it actually gets given to people. That will cause inflation. There's another movement, MMT, which is this, you know, I don't even entirely understand MMT, I must say, but it's going on, and this whole repo thing, all various forms of money printing are going on by the back door. But that effectively, it's all it is, money printing. And money printing is, as we've already seen, taxation without legislation. It's taxation by the back door. I think we're going to see a lot more of that. And when the next crisis comes, how are they going to deal with it? They can't raise taxes, so they'll do it by the back door, money printing. Some bamboozling term, you know, like when the term quantitative easing came out, you know, nobody could pronounce it for about 5 years.
well, it makes money printing, it disguises it. It's something very sophisticated. Basically, they're printing money. And that's where I see MMT leading us, because both parties are in favor of it. It's basically, if you can issue debt in your own currency, there's no limit to the debt that you can issue. You can just simply instruct the central bank to pay for it, which is, I think, where we're heading as I see this next decade coming upon us as one of taxation and inflation, which is interesting.
The idea that Donald Trump, if he wins, I mean, he's obviously a low tax guy, but he's also an extremely vain man. And he's a braggadocio, if you like. And the idea, I don't mean to insult your president, because he makes me laugh whenever I hear him speak. But, you know, the idea that he's going to act with restraint when it comes to, you know, government spending projects, he's not. He's going to want to open the spigots and get that bridge built and get whatever it is built so that it reflects well on him. He's more Henry VIII than Henry VII, put it that way.
Yeah, well, it's always been a popular device during election years for politicians to kiss babies and hand out lollipops and promise lots of free stuff.
They're going to be really big orange lollipops.
I know. Well, listen, Dominic, fascinating book. In fact, I see it as a continuation of somebody we both loved reading his book, Charles Adams, Fight, Flight, or Fraud. And I would encourage our listeners to read this. You would be surprised of how much of history has been determined by taxation and how much taxation and inflation will be the biggest issues of this decade. And the name of the book is called Daylight Robbery: How Tax Shaped Our Past and Will Change Our Future, by Dominic Frisby. Dominic, it's been a real pleasure to have you on the program. Great to speak with you again, and kudos to you for writing such a great book.
Oh, you're very kind, Jim. And, you know, I've listened to your program for over 10 years now, and what you do is it's a great thing. And so it's, you know, it's a pleasure and an honor and everything else to be interviewed by you. And as I said, the book started because of a casual remark by you on this very show.
Well, thank you so much. And once again, name of the book, Daylight Robbery, by Dominic Frisby. Highly recommend it. Great read. You'll learn a lot about history, the kind of history you never read in a history book. Dominic, all the best to you, sir.
You too.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.